What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Hi, everyone. Sophia Bush here. Welcome to Work in Progress, where I talk to people who inspire me about how they got to where they are and where they think they're still going. If you haven't noticed by now, I know it's hard not to notice, but just in case you haven't noticed by now, some of my biggest inspirations on this planet are journalists. I mean, I was a journalism student, shout out to USC Annenberg, which is why I was so excited to talk to today's guest, Katie Couric. Guys, Katie Couric is here. If you didn't grow up watching her every morning, I don't know what to tell you, you missed out. Since her Today Show days, she's become the first woman ever to solo anchor the evening news. She had a talk show, traveled the country for numerous documentaries, started her own media company, and also has her own podcast. Katie has done it all, and we pretty much covered it all in this episode. Enjoy. So to start, I'm just so excited that you're here. I had this kind of moment prepping for this where I realized, oh, I think hindsight, they say, is 20/20, and you know, cliches are cliches because they're true. And I realized for me that as a kid who grew up watching you in real time and watching Oprah in real time and being obsessed with Murphy Brown. I mean, it was my favorite show on TV.
Really?
My parents were like, you're very strange. I was six. And oh, you know, that was like all I wanted to watch, Wheel of Fortune and Murphy Brown. And I don't think I realized what a deep impact having these iconic intellectual thought leaders to watch made on me until I look back at my own history and realize that, you know, I helped organize a protest at my school in the eighth grade, and I went to college for a theater school degree and wound up realizing that I didn't love how small the department felt and transferring into the journalism school and studying political science. And all of these things have informed my life, but I don't think I would have known I could be it if I hadn't seen it.
Right. So, well, I'm a big believer in that and always have been. The idea of watching other people to really understand the possibilities that you have. And that's a really nice thing to hear, because that's something I've always been cognizant of. When I was on the Today Show, I really wanted to make sure that I was seen as smart and competent and capable, that I could handle a lot of different kinds of interviews. Mm-hmm. Because there was a time when women, I think, were relegated to the second banana position, kind of in service of the male leader or the male figure on a lot of platforms or a lot of shows or a lot of, you know, avenues. And so the idea that I helped someone like you see that women could achieve a lot of things is really one of the reasons. I mean, the true reason is because I love the work, but a secondary and very important reason is because I thought I could help in some way shift the culture.
Yeah.
And I think it was really important to me as someone who grew up in during sort of the height of the women's movement, or at least, you know, one wave of feminism, that I would incorporate that and help spread the word about possibilities.
And I imagine that it takes a job and makes it feel like a mission. It infuses things with purpose.
Yeah.
When you really know what the potential impact can be.
I think you're right. I mean, I think you're attracted to a job maybe for the nuts and bolts day-to-day work. And when your skills or talents intersect with the actual duties that you're performing. But I think another aspect is, how can I take this, certainly when you have a visible job, and I think there's a bigger responsibility and obligation, but how can I take this platform and make sure that I handle it responsibly and even help move the ball forward in some way? Mm-hmm. And I think that has informed and imbued me professionally my entire life, whether it was, you know, greater opportunities for women or educating people about colon cancer and then starting a movement, starting Stand Up to Cancer. Mm-hmm. So all these things, I think, built on one another. And once I had a position where I did have some influence, figuring out how to use that influence as best as I could.
Yes. And you do it so well.
Well, I don't know about that, but I try.
I mean, you know, from the outside, I think we all can sort of, we see other people more clearly than I think any of us knows how to see ourselves. But I'm curious, because you've mentioned so many of the things that I really want to get into and talk about, how you've built movements and how you've led cultural change. But I'm curious about these building blocks, as you say. What's the first block? Who is Katie Couric as a kid? Were you passionate about causes? Were you a super inquisitive little girl? Where does your sort of brain and passion, where does that begin to sprout?
I was passionate about causes and very inquisitive. So yes and yes to that. You know, I was a very outgoing child. I was the youngest of four kids, and I'm writing a memoir now, and I was thinking about the fact that my oldest sister, Emily, used to say that they'd put me in the middle of the table in my little baby carrier, and everybody would circle around me and ooh and ah and pay attention to me. So I got a lot. I had an audience from a very early age. And I think that, you know, that gave me a lot of confidence. And also, I'm just wired to be super extroverted. You know, where does that come from? I think some of it, it's nature and nurture. Mm-hmm. So I was always asking questions, saying hi. I never met a stranger. I think my mom used to worry that I was like a puppy dog when I got out of college, that I would put myself in danger because I was too friendly. Mm-hmm. But I think that, plus I remember having a fair for the United Way with Diana Sirelman, my next door neighbor. And we had like a fortune teller. I think I was nine, and we had, you know, games and prizes. I'm sure it was super, super low touch and not very sophisticated. But I remember we made $11.62 for United Way. And the local paper came over and took our picture, and I had a little safe. And it was my brother Johnny's safe. And they wrote up our carnival, or whatever we called it. And I've always cared about, I have always had this philanthropic bent from an early age. Then my mom, so I was always trying to raise money for different organizations. And then when I was in high school, my mom had all of us, except for Emily, because I'm not sure the camp was available when Emily, my sister, who was 10 years older than I, was younger. But we all volunteered at a camp for blind kids in Washington, D.C. It was at Mount Vernon Junior College. It was sponsored by the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind, and we were all camp counselors at this camp. So my other sister, Kiki, who goes by Clara now, my brother, Johnny, who likes to be called John, and I all were counselors at this camp. And I think it really taught me to see beyond myself, beyond my little microcosmic world in Northern Virginia, and be exposed to all different kinds of kids, and kids who were less fortunate and who also, you know, were in very different circumstances because of their disability and or disabilities, because it ran the gamut. And there were some who were multiple handicapped is what they were called, but now I guess they'd be called differently abled. And so there were some kids with learning disabilities and blindness, or some with just blindness. And they did come from all socioeconomic levels, but it just was such a formative experience for me.
Such a stretching of perspective.
Yeah. And just to be exposed to people who are so different than you are, and also to feel that you are serving them in some ways and helping them. And we'd go on field trips, we'd go swimming, we'd go to the Folklife Festival on the Mall in Washington, D.C. We'd go bowling. I know it sounds crazy because you think about blind children going bowling, but, you know, to literally have these experiences, and I was going to say, see things through their eyes, and in a way you do, even though they can't see, to understand their experiences, I think was a really wonderful way to build empathy. And I think empathy is so important, and I've always been a very empathetic person, but I think that made me even more so, and my siblings as well.
And you mentioned that you grew up in Virginia, and this was in D.C., this camp.
Right.
What were these, I guess, what would you say are some of the most important lessons your parents taught you? Because it would seem to me that service is one.
Right.
What an amazing thing that they said, you know, our family's going to go and volunteer and work with other kids and really create community in a space that I would imagine a lot of other people weren't exposed to. So I'm curious kind of about family dynamics and what, in hindsight, you think your parents were really passionate about teaching you guys.
You know, I've often tried to figure out the secret sauce of my parents and their parenting skills. I think that they were incredibly involved, but not so involved. It was creepy. You know, they weren't helicopter parents, but they were, you know, we were a really strong family unit. Education was incredibly important. My parents were both really smart. My dad was particularly erudite and well-read, just sharp. He was a journalist and read everything and could talk fluently about almost any topic. And my mom was very kind of clever and smart and funny and just quick. And so I think it was the emphasis on education. You know, we had a lot of family time. You know, we ate together every night. It was very, I mean, old-fashioned. My fondest memories are eating, you know, in the summer on our porch and having corn on the cob and fresh tomatoes and going to the swimming pool all day. And, you know, it was just a very wholesome, wonderful environment. They supported us in everything we did. And I think encouraged us and in a way pushed us, but they weren't too pushy. And I think they saw education as the real key to improving yourself and improving your station in life. And so I think that's something. They were quite demanding in terms of our grades. But by the time I came along, the fourth kid, I think they were more relaxed and I wasn't as, you know, probably as driven as my siblings were, especially my older sisters. Even though I was driven, I was kind of a goof off and I could kind of get away as a typical youngest child, sort of being charming and funny. And I think I took shortcuts and I procrastinated and I was smart, but I wasn't as disciplined, I think, as I might have been. I wish I had been more disciplined.
Do you think, though, that that tendency to procrastinate when you were young is part of what allows you to be so good on the fly as a journalist?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think the fact that I waited to the last minute and would do my homework, waiting for the bus in the morning, and my dad would get so exasperated with me, I think it did. I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie, and I like waiting to the last minute. And I, you know, if I have 40 minutes to get ready, I'll, you know, goof off until I have 20 minutes to get ready. And I don't know what that is, but
I don't know why.
And so I think it's actually, and then I'm so stressed, but I think I must like stress if there's such a phenomenon. And so I think
procrastinating.
Yeah, I like pressure. And I also was a pretty good writer from an early age. And my dad, I think, recognized it as a writer himself. And he really encouraged me to pursue journalism because I think he saw that I was a master procrastinator and that I was a pretty good writer.
What were you reading back then?
Oh, I was thinking about that the other day. I was been going through all these papers and I was thinking about some of my favorite children's books. Well, early on, of course, I read sort of the typical books, you know, Dr. Seuss and P.D. Eastman, Are You My Mother, and Go, Dog, Go. And my great aunt would send me books about Flora McFlimsey, I think is her name. I can't remember, but she was a doll. And I have to find those books because they're so cute and sweet. So I was reading in high school, in junior high, and I remember I loved From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, which I think won a Caldecott Award. I remember I liked a book called Light a Single Candle, which was written by, I think, a blind girl. I also liked A Patch of Blue, which was later a movie with Sidney Poitier. So I just read all kinds of weird things. But I did love to read, and I wish I had read more because I sometimes people ask me about kids, and I do think reading, being an avid reader and an enthusiastic reader, is definitely the key to life. Mm-hmm. And you know, you learn so much, and you can take, you know, you can just have all these different experiences, and I think that's another thing that really helps you develop empathy.
Yes. And you can really get inside of other people's heads and worlds. And I know that you also were a huge Mary Tyler Moore fan.
I was. Yeah. Were you?
Yes.
When you were like three?
And when she would go into that office. Well, I was a Nick at Night junkie as a kid because my parents they were pretty watchful of what I was watching. So like Mary Tyler Moore and Mr. Ed were on in my house all the time. I remember when Mr. Ed went off the air and I cried. I mean, I was inconsolable.
Can you sing the theme song to Mr. Ed?
I don't know.
A horse is a horse, of course, of course. This famous Mr. Ed.
Yes.
Get back to the source and ask the horse. He'll give you the answer that you endorse. He's always on a steady course. Talk to Mr. Ed.
That's amazing.
Yackety yack, they're doing waste their time. Anyway, it's
you
so
got
funny
because
that
yeah.
was these were the shows that I loved too.
Yeah, and I remember
Wilbur.
It was just so good, and I remember thinking, you know, even as a kid, watching Mary Tyler Moore advocating for making as much as her male coworkers,
right?
And I remember asking my dad, you know, who owned a business, I was like, you pay everybody the same, right? You know, my parents were so taken aback. And, you know, it spawned all these interesting conversations. And I think, again, in hindsight, I realize how impactful good messaging can be in content.
Yeah.
And
oh, it's true. I mean, if you look at the arc of feminism and you think about Mary Tyler Moore, she was such a trailblazer. Mm-hmm. And you say that watching me or Oprah helped you realize the possibilities you had. You know, when I was growing up, most women were stay-at-home moms. You know, women who worked were a real anomaly. And so to see this young career woman. Both my sisters married pretty much right out of college. Mm. And for me as a young girl, 10, 11, 12, to see someone like Mary Tyler Moore having a career, making it on her own, driving to Minneapolis, and having a life that was complete without a male to complete her, thank you, Tom Cruise, is that, you know, was so exciting to me and so revelatory as well. And so that show, I've often said, I give it credit for me kind of understanding that I had that there was a path out there for me that wasn't necessarily getting married and having kids in your 20s, but to have a profession. And, you know, it sounds funny now, but women who worked when I was coming of age were really few and far between.
Yeah. And I think something that's so interesting, I've had this debate with some people who say, you know, why aren't, if a woman wants to be a stay-at-home mom, like, why is that bad per feminism? And my whole response is always, it isn't. What was bad was that we weren't given any other option. We were told that our only value was to be subservient and serve others rather than to ask what we need.
Being in a more of a supportive role.
Right. And you know, I think we should be able to do all of it. I think if you want to be a mom, and if you don't. And if you want to be a mom with a career, do that. I think that the pushing of culture toward honoring women as equally valued means that culture should honor all of our options equally, but that you should never have that scene that we've all watched on Mary Tyler Moore, where her boss says, well, you know, women don't need to make as much money because they're not supporting a wife and kids. And it's like, which we're supporting ourselves. I'm confused.
Right.
And so,
well, yeah, I think that sort of implicit bias sometimes enters into the conversation, even if it's a man and he's not married with a family. I think that there have been a lot of studies that show that that really has an impact on your salary, especially if you're a man and people think, oh, he has got a family to support. But all this thinking has been so deeply ingrained, and I think it's starting to shift. And as far as your comment about women who work inside the home, and, you know, I think that Melinda Gates recently cited that women spend 7 hours of additional unpaid labor doing things around the house in addition to their full-time jobs. And I think that you can't really have equality in the workplace if you don't have equality at home. And I think that's starting to change as well. But, you know, I agree with you, but I think it comes back to that word purpose for stay-at-home moms or women who work inside the home or people who decide to really focus on raising their kids. You know, I think those people should be, people who make those choices should be respected and honored. But I do think it's important to have some sense of purpose that goes beyond perhaps just raising your kids. Because what I've seen and what I would worry about if I had channeled all my energy into that is when your kids leave, you know, and your goal is to give them roots and wings, so you hope that they do fly away, that you're not left feeling that you have no sense of purpose in the world, that you have no kind of options. So I think it is important. And I think for a long time, women felt it was selfish, but to focus on their own passions and what they like to do, whether it's volunteer work or philanthropy or writing or, and the other thing that I also think about, and I've really emphasized to my two daughters, is the importance of being financially independent. Now, that's not for everyone, but for me, I never liked the feeling of relying on someone else, because I do think it really affects the power dynamics in a relationship.
Sure.
Gives you less of a say. And I always wanted to be able to have my own agency in a relationship. And so there's a really good book by Leslie Bennett that I read early in my career called The Feminine Mistake. This book talks about women who decide to give up everything for their husbands and families. And The only sort of flashing red light about that choice is things happen. Shit happens. Mm-hmm. Men leave their wives for their assistants or their colleagues. People die, as mm-hmm. in the case of my husband, Jay, mm-hmm. who died when he was 42 years old and our girls were 6 and 2. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's really important to have that financial independence and to be able to support yourself. Now, not everyone might not necessarily agree with me, but I just think it's something that is really important for my girls, mm-hmm. and it's something for young women. I think it's important to think about.
Yeah. My mom and I have had so many conversations about that because my mom always worked, and then I think when I was 2, decided to stay home with me full time, and is such an amazing mom, but, you know, had me in her 30s, so she'd had a career.
Right.
And it's really interesting because she's very frank with me about how she wouldn't change anything and is so glad she was home with me, but wants me to always make my own money.
Yeah.
And my parents are still married and they're like weirdly very cute and they hold hands and I'm like, what's wrong with you people?
No,
what's
that's
going
so
on?
Nice.
You know, they're no.
So
they're,
did she go back to work as you got older?
She went back to work when I was in college. Mm-hmm. She actually went back and started working with my dad, and it was meant to be temporary. My dad was in transition and had a studio manager who moved. He was a photographer for 40 years mm-hmm. and retired recently. But my mom said, you know, I used to run the studio. I can do this while we find somebody new. And then my dad called me and was like, it's so fun having your mom around.
That's
and
so
we take
nice.
The carpool lane to work. Uh-huh. And it's awesome. And I'm not going to look for anybody. Don't tell her yet.
Where do they live?
In Pasadena.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They're pretty cool folks. But yeah, it was interesting to be able to have that conversation with her where she just said, you know, your dad and I are lucky. Like, we've done the work, we've stuck out the fights, we've done all the good and all the bad, and we're in this together. But I hate having to check in with him before I do something, before, you know, I book a plane ticket or whatever, just because she was like, I don't have that agency.
Right. And remember, I mean, you're way too young for I Love Lucy, but you know, you think
no,
about Lucy.
Ma'am, the Nick at Night reruns, come on.
Well, if you think of Lucy Ricardo,
yeah.
I mean, how weird it was, you know, and other shows, by the way, it wasn't just that show. I mean, for many years, the whole trope would be the woman, you know, getting in trouble for buying something
yes.
or going shopping and kind of having to get permission from her husband to buy a new pair of shoes or whatever. And, you know, it just, it does seem so retro. And that really is what life is like. If you don't earn your own money,
right.
Then you don't get to spend your own money. And it's just so funny how much things have changed. Mm-hmm. And I just love being able to do what I want with the money I've made that I've worked hard to mm-hmm. to get, and to not have to be beholden to someone or not to have to ask permission, which almost mm-hmm. seems ludicrous to even discuss. But that is mm-hmm. sort of what it was like for many women. And that's the only reason I do encourage my girls to be financially independent so
yes.
they can have some freedom mm-hmm. and to have their bank account, their partner's bank account eventually, and then a joint bank account for
right.
joint expenses.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's so interesting as we talk about how society evolves to take care of everyone, you know, men and women and everyone who identifies in between, and figuring out how to remove, to your point, some of the dynamics that can create imbalance so that there just never is any. You know, how nice to be in a partnership without these strange unsaid tensions.
Right, right. And I think men are, you know, I think the hunter-gatherer thing is starting to shift a little bit too, because I think as men take on more responsibility at home and as women make more money, these very restrictive gender roles that have been so, as I said, ingrained in our consciousness and subconsciousness and reinforced through images and mass media, I think it's starting to change.
Yeah,
I really do.
So before you started analyzing things like mass media and gender roles, the space between being an avid reader in junior high and high school and becoming the journalist you are, you went to UVA. And were you studying journalism there? What was your path into this?
Well, they didn't have a journalism department per se. It's a liberal arts school. But I majored in English and history, American studies. My dad encouraged me to just write a lot, and I loved English, and I loved writing, so I really enjoyed my major. But then I wrote for the school newspaper during the summers. I worked at radio stations in Washington, D.C., and was just exposed to that world. And then, of course, worked at ABC, CNN, and then worked in local news. So I spent a lot of days, weeks and months and years kind of just honing my skills as a reporter, feeling more comfortable on air, understanding how to tell a story, how to get important sound bites, how to make people feel comfortable, how to get the most from interviews. And, you know, I am a firm believer in Malcolm Gladwell's edict that it takes 10,000 hours doing something to become really good at it. And so I spent that and then some. But so, you know, I just was really, it just, I picked the perfect profession for my personality and my skill set, I think.
Right. When you talk about learning how to make people comfortable and figuring out how to ask the right questions, what are some of those lessons that you can pass on to people who are in the midst of their putting in their 10,000 hours?
Well, I think for anyone, sort of this is sort of if I had to give a master class, it would be on developing EQ, you know, emotional intelligence. And I think that serves you no matter what you're doing in any career. So I think you, first of all, you know, I think people know when you're interested and when you're not. Right. So you're really good at eye contact, and that's good. No, that's good. And kind of, I can feel you're engaged with what we're talking about, or you're faking it really well.
No, I'm so excited.
And so I think eye contact's super important. I think, you know, I think some people do have better innate skills when it comes to reading people, like how to read a room and how to read people. So I think kind of getting a sense of who someone is and trying to make that person comfortable. You know, I'm the kind of person who walks into a room and if someone's standing by themselves, I make a beeline to that person because it just breaks my heart to see someone who may feel awkward or alone. I mean, that's just, I don't know. That's the person I've always been, kind of like, who needs help?
Yeah, except now you're going up to the person who's alone and you're Katie Couric and they're like, what's happening?
No, not really. But I will go up and introduce myself and say hi. And
that's so nice.
You know, so that's where my outgoing extroverted personality really comes into play. But I would say, you know, and think about it, preparation's really important. Yeah. You know, the fact that you knew I went to UVA, you know, nothing's worse than having someone. I can tell, like, after 20 seconds if someone isn't prepared or has done zero homework. And it's kind of insulting, honestly.
Yes.
But you see that a lot. You know, they'll ask really dumb questions, and you're like, you could have found that out on, like, a 45-second Wikipedia, you know, read. And so I think preparing and thinking about it in advance is really important. And, you know, is there something interesting about this person that they would really like to talk about that they haven't talked about a lot?
Right.
So I just think also tonally for me, it's been important. You know, I worked with Jeff Zucker early on in my career and we talked about the tone of every interview. And sometimes the tone is a little more combative and sometimes it's more empathetic. And so I think going in, it's very important to be conscious of tone and how you're interacting with somebody. But
yeah.
I just think all those things, whether it's a job interview, body language is super important. I'm still a firm believer in good manners, mm-hmm. eye contact, a firm handshake, thank mm-hmm. you notes, you know, all those things. I think just being well-mannered is really mm-hmm. important too. So I think if you can think of all of that, I think it can be helpful.
Mm. My mom's a huge proponent of a handwritten thank you note too.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying.
I should do that more. Ooh, and I don't.
It's
yeah,
hard.
It is hard. But even if you can't do that, to write an email.
Yeah. That's really very true. The follow-up is a thing that I think some people assume is just, you know, frivolous, or I don't want to bother that person. They already gave me some of their time.
Yeah.
And it always feels like the opposite. When someone yeah. follows up with me, I know I'm always so grateful for the fact that they thought to. So
I think the other thing is you have to be a good listener, you know, mm-hmm. because if you are engaged and you're a good listener, then you'll be able to have a conversation go naturally where it should go. Mm-hmm. And I always had a list of questions, you know, when I was doing interviews, but I'd always try to, if someone brought up something that was surprising mm-hmm. or controversial, then you have to be kind of ready to take an interview in a very different direction.
Sure. And what do you do when something gets controversial or to reference what you said a moment ago, you're walking into a situation you know might be combative, you know? Mm-hmm. We think about the current political landscape
we're
literally having questions about whether or not we deserve human rights. You know, this feels insane.
It does, doesn't it?
How do you suit up for that kind of combative moment, but still make sure that you're going to get to the meat of something rather than have just, you know, a fight where no one's listening to each other anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, you're talking about sort of day-to-day conversation or...
I guess I'm curious, you know, for you, because you've had the access of the position as a journalist to interview so many people who many of us watch, you know, from the sidelines or, you know, on Twitter or C-SPAN, and we're just like screaming at the TV. And I'm curious how you press to the center of an issue and still keep your cool and don't make someone feel alienated, but certainly challenge them.
Yeah, I mean, I did an hour for Nat Geo on white anxiety, and I spoke to a lot of working class white men about sort of their feelings of frustration and alienation and mm-hmm. kind of the economic uncertainty. And, you know, I think you try to have a very open mind. But I think a lot of it is in the approach. I think today we're so ready to pounce at someone who doesn't agree with us. And I think you do get a lot more, I think you are able to advance a conversation a lot more with gentle persuasion. Or, you know, I was thinking recently, the president said that horrible comment about the four freshman members of Congress that...
Who, of course, are women of color.
Right. Mm. And although I have to agree with people who said I was sad to see AOC bring up race when it came to Nancy Pelosi, because I don't believe that that was kind of part of the conflict. I think it was more incrementalism versus radical change and generational and philosophical difference.
On Nancy's perspective.
Yeah, I think so.
Because it's obviously quite racist on Donald Trump's.
Yes. Hmm. And I was thinking, why did he say that? I mean, it's so... Nothing is that surprising at this point, but why would you say something so horrendous and horrific and blatantly racist? And I just... And so I was thinking, well, how would I have a conversation with someone about that? Mm. And are there people who don't have a problem with those sentiments? And clearly there are. Mm-hmm. And he is appealing to sort of the worst side of humanity mm-hmm. in making that comment. And I think you can feel that you can even be anti-immigration or feel that immigration should be more restrictive or there should be comprehensive immigration reform or we can't have completely porous borders. You can believe all those things without resorting to that kind of hatred mm-hmm. and nastiness.
But I think so much about what President Obama said, and he said that the presidency does not reveal, obviously in his case as a man, the presidency does not reveal the man or does not make you the man that you are.
It reveals
the man that you mm-hmm. are. And we've always known who Donald Trump is. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like a surreal time to be alive because, to your point, we have historically analyzed positions which often come from opposite perspectives, but it has never felt like this.
No, it hasn't.
And I think what is interesting, you know, when you talk about that generation gap between someone like a Nancy Pelosi and an AOC, I understand at times when I try to figure out why Pelosi speaks on certain things the way she does, I think about her age, I think about her perspective, I think about her entire life moving through the women's movement.
Right.
And the women's movement for women who look like us is recommitting to so many of the ideals that Gloria Steinem set. It is also realizing that we have to go so much deeper because the patriarchy has often bifurcated sex and race mm-hmm. to maintain its stronghold on society. Mm-hmm. And I think so many young women are saying, we can't do this anymore. And especially women who look like us have to be out there advocating on the front lines for women of color.
No, and I agree, by the way, and I'm so excited about that development. Mm-hmm. And I think I did something on The View recently, and I said, I think Nancy Pelosi needs to be much less dismissive, but there also has to be some level of respect from younger women. And I think
and both are true. The idea
for us to kind of cannibalize our efforts and to work at cross purposes is just so unnecessary and actually advantageous for people who don't want to see progress made. So, you know, I think there can be a difference in opinion or approaches, but I think sometimes we have to make sure women keep their eye on the prize. Mm-hmm. And I agree with all those things that you said, and I'm really heartened and encouraged by it. But I also think there has to, you know, you have to kind of respect your elders
of
and
course.
The people who have come before you. But also I think you have to appreciate the changes that haven't come and the impatience of a younger generation to really to move the ball forward in a way that it keeps getting blocked at the goalpost.
Yes.
And to use a sports analogy.
Yeah, I like that. And you know,
I'm thinking
you're right.
of women's soccer when I say this,
oh my
by
God,
the way.
Same. By the way, that team, yeah. I just like, I'm their biggest fan. To your point, I think it can be really hard as younger women who have this frustration with where we're not to have as deep an understanding of where we weren't. And while I don't think we can ever rest on our success because there's more work to do, the point that you were making was that we do need to have some reverence and be willing to hear, I think, the experience and I would think perhaps some of the fear that the women who came before us have for how we might fail if we're not careful. And I understand that when you think about, you know, I have that conversation with my mom a lot and she'll kind of get into this thing with me where I go, you're making me feel super judged. And I know you're not trying to do that. And she'll go, I'm so sorry. I love you. And I don't want you to be hurt or I don't want this to happen. And I'm just expressing my fear about what could go wrong. And obviously, when we're getting into politics and social movements, it's a much, much bigger space. But I think about it a bit in the same way, where people who've come before us and really paved the road have seen what's been worse and have advice. And I think very often that advice is wonderful. It's advice we need to take into account. And I also think it can be our job. And I say our job, even though I'm sort of straddling both of these demographics. You know, I look at the women coming after me, even in, you know, the AOCs of the world who are like, change now, you know, more radical change now. And I also agree with what they're saying. And I think that in my estimation of having been overeager and sometimes made mistakes, and also knowing that I want people to succeed to the best of their ability, I think we need to put it all in the pot and figure out what the new kind of the new stew, the new tea looks like. And so what do you, I'm just curious what you think is the way forward.
Well, I think this whole conversation speaks to the judgment and my way of the highway attitude that I think too many people have. And I think the fact that we just need to listen to each other a little bit more and have more empathy. You know, I look at my generation, and it was really one of the first that went out into the workforce.
Yeah.
You know, when I got into television, it was a male-dominated industry. The women were relegated to supportive roles. And there were very few producers, correspondents, technical people who were female. And I think, you know, I'm of two minds. I can understand people's impatience, but I also know that change is really hard. And we live in New York and LA, where a certain attitude prevails, and it's not necessarily the attitude of other places in the country. And I think people need to be persuaded. I think the incrementalism of the Obama administration wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because radical change often, I think, comes with a huge backlash that sometimes sets us back even further. So I am so excited and appreciate the enthusiasm of younger people who want to change things now. And I think AOC is getting people to talk about things and consider them. And by, you know, sometimes you have to be really radical to get change at all, right? Because then you move forward and then everybody settles back a little bit. But it's what starts the conversation finally, and this conflict between the old and the new. So I think that we just all, I mean, I think everybody pretty much wants the same thing. And I think the road to getting there can be debated. But, you know, I'm not saying people should be bowing down to older women or more mature women, but I think they should appreciate their struggles. And, you know, I think in many cases, I've been talking to a lot of my contemporaries about this. We had to go along to get along. And some of the things that are just plain out unacceptable for younger women were things that were part of the culture that we would roll our eyes at or, you know, kind of talk about privately. But to change the whole status quo, we wouldn't have even gotten a seat at the table. So it would have been too risky, I think. So I think every time results in a certain behavior that's right for that time. And I'm glad that young women are now saying, wait a second, what you put up with or tolerated is no longer acceptable.
Well, and that incrementalism you speak of, that fascinates me when it comes to women in the workplace in the era that you're discussing. Because to your point, you guys broke down the doors and got in the room, but you still had to deal with so much bad behavior in the workplace. And I know we all have as well. But I'm fascinated by what you're saying, that in a way, as women, you had to band together, roll your eyes, figure out how to survive it, figure out how to sidestep the
navigate
bad editor,
it,
the creepy producer. And that in a way, your chipping away at the system has allowed finally so many of us to say, this has to change. And I
said, has put more women in positions of power.
Yes. And that's incremental too. You know, it's still not enough. We don't
no,
have parity.
Of course.
But I'm fascinated because I think about even when I first started working in TV, it was the same. We all would talk about, you know, how creepy our boss was, the creator and executive producer of my first show. But we figured out how to sort of navigate around it. And we would, you know, we would read each other's texts from him and figure out, do you say something to this? Do you not? And make sure if you're, you know, if you get invited to dinner, you call three of us and we all go together. And it's interesting to see the ways in which now we're talking about how to change systems in the workplace. But when you really pull back and look at it, we're talking about it. This is a national conversation. It's been time, you know, as the phrase goes, but we still have so much work to do to actually change the operating procedures of the culture in the workplace.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we have to change the systems, but I think back then, oftentimes, because there was a patriarchy at the workplace that, you know, these complaints wouldn't be taken seriously. Yeah. HR has problems even today with the changing workplace in terms of protecting the status quo and being beholden to the status quo.
Yeah, they don't really protect women.
So I think, you know, it's just really, really interesting. I think if you put yourselves, if some young women put themselves in the shoes of older women, say in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and imagine what it was like and how they had to kind of deal with a system that was not exactly receptive to their complaints or issues, they would understand that we've made a lot of strides. But at the same time, again, I appreciate women who are saying, wait a second, this is totally unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy about that.
And both can be true.
Yeah.
We've made incredible strides and we still have a long way to go.
But we don't have to pit ourselves against each other. I mean, to me, that it's just, that seems to be sort of the culture right now, infusing sort of conflict in every conversation.
I'm curious about, again, all of your wisdom and perspective on this. And I would like to go back when we were speaking a few moments ago about, you know, you talking about that initial time in the news and how few women there were. And, you know, there's nobody on the set, maybe except for you. You know, it's not like there's female sound engineers at the time or any
of this. Well, this was 1979. So there were like production assistants and what were once called secretaries.
Right.
You know, it wasn't quite Mad Men, but there was a dearth of sort of female, of a female presence there.
Do you think that because so few of us for so long got in the room, that that influenced, because you do hear people talk about, oh, well, you know, women are so competitive with each other. And it's like, well, yeah, because the patriarchy's made us compete with each other because it's told us there's only one of us allowed.
Is that true, though? You know, I'm actually fascinated by that whole topic.
Me too.
Because I feel that men are uber competitive, you know, and I've been kind of thinking about this a lot, about women not being competitive and supporting other women. And yes, that's great. It is great. On the other hand, is there something inherently wrong about being competitive? You know, about wanting to achieve and wanting to be better than, or wanting that promotion. You know, I think it's such a fine line.
I think it's about the kind of competition.
But what I'm saying is, and should men become more like women and be less competitive and more supportive? Or do men know what they're doing in a workplace in terms of, you know, I think they're much more quietly competitive. I think that the archetype is seeing the cat fight. You know, I think that the three main anchors, when it was Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, and Dan Rather, were competitive as hell. And yet it was never portrayed as this vicious catfight.
Yeah.
And there is no real, there's no expression in the lexicon, really, that describes men. I mean, would it be dog eat dog? I don't know. But I think this idea has become so elevated that I just wonder, I'm still sort of processing and formulating my point of view on it. But I just wonder if it has been overemphasized with women.
I love that you just said that. I'm processing and formulating my view. So many people feel like they have to know how they feel about something all of the time. And to be willing to say, yeah, I'm trying to analyze this. You know, this is interesting. It doesn't do well for us to cannibalize each other, but also some healthy competition can be good. And I'm going to figure out thoughts as I continue to research. I love the permission you just offered to so many other people who are listening to say, I don't completely know yet. This is what I find interesting about it. And just to be there.
Yeah.
That's huge in the, you know, in this world where we're supposed to know all the time.
Well, I do think that people are supposed to have a very strong point of view on everything. Mm. And I think the social media environment really encourages that.
Exacerbates.
And I think that again, thoughtful dialogue and conversation is just not it's not good television. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, it's not manufactured outrage. It's just conversation. And, you know, and it's nice that you give people a space to be able to kind of talk about these things and figure them out in real time or just talk about it.
Yeah. I think we need it. And it is interesting to me because that idea of good television, you know, we both have worked in the space for a long time. And I so often hear more often than not men at the top say, well, that's not good television. And I'm like, well, you want everything to be a cage match and I'm not interested in watching that. I actually think this would be amazing television. You're just not giving us the space to do this. So we're out here making podcasts, you know? It's like the ladies are always going to get it done. And if you close one door, we're just going to build another one. So I sort of love that. When I think about the doors that you were opening, you know, working at CNN and being in this breaking news space and, you know, becoming a reporter in Miami. Do you remember, I'm just curious if we can take it back a minute because I have so many questions I want to ask you. Do you remember what your first on-camera story was?
My first on-camera story was at CNN and I was an assistant assignment editor. I was 23 or 24 years old. Maybe 23. And the Stuart Lurie, who had been the editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe, was the Washington bureau chief of CNN. And I think he knew that I was ambitious and wanted to be a reporter. So he offered me an opportunity to go to the White House and say what the president was doing that day. Well, I had never been on camera. I'd never done a report. I had no idea what I was doing. I remember exactly what I was wearing. I remember going there. I remember having diarrhea all night because I was such a nervous wreck.
No.
And yeah, and I got there and TMI. And I got there and the anchors said to each other, "Who is that girl? She looks like she's about 16 years old," during the commercial break.
Whoa.
And I was like, oh shit, this is not exactly a big confidence booster. So I went on, I said what the president was doing that day. I would very proudly pronounce Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I was terrible. And I looked young, I sounded young. I'm sure I looked like I had no confidence at all. And the president of CNN called and said, "I never want to see that girl on the air again." Yeah, it was a disaster.
What?
With a capital D.
How terrible. How do you crawl out of that devastating emotional hole?
Well, it was obviously very upsetting. And I remember the assignment desk editor, Bill Hensel, telling me that, who was such a nice guy. And I was devastated, but I just thought, I'll show him. And to be honest with you, in hindsight, he was exactly right. They should never have done that. Mm. I should never have been there. I wasn't good. I stunk.
You weren't ready.
I wasn't ready. I hadn't had enough experience. Mm. And while I appreciate Stuart Lurie, may he rest in peace, you know, giving me this opportunity, I wasn't ready. So I kind of made a vow that I was going to get good at doing it. And I was, you know, going to continue working on it. And I was a producer and I moved to Atlanta for CNN. I produced a show from noon to two. So I did a lot of behind the scenes jobs in television, which I think made me better because it made me sort of understand what was needed. And then I started reporting. I had a very supportive anchor who let me do reporting and worked with me. I went to a voice coach who helped me kind of use my voice better because I was kind of like this a lot, you know, because I spoke from my throat instead of my diaphragm.
Wow.
I mean, it's not something I'm conscious of now. Now my voice, I feel so low. You have a kind of, our voices are a little similar. Although yours is much raspier than mine.
It's funny because I've sounded like this since I was a kid.
Really?
And I remember,
I like it.
Remember when we still had landlines, like the phone on the wall?
Yes, I remember landlines.
Like, it's crazy. And
I'm 62, so I do remember landlines.
So you know, and telemarketers used to call my house and I'd pick up the phone and go, hello. And they'd want to talk about things. And I remember my dad, I didn't know he was behind me, cackling, laughing when I went, sir, I can't talk to you about this. I'm 9. And the guy was like, what? On the other end of the phone and goes, are your parents home? And I don't know why. I've just always sounded like this.
Yeah, I like it. Thanks. It's kind of, what do you call it? Raspy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I have, you know, it's so funny because I walk around now and if I don't have any makeup on or people just, you know, aren't cognizant of their surroundings and I start talking, people always look. And because I think for so long on the Today Show and maybe a little bit on the evening news, people would hear my voice because they'd be doing other things during the show. And so my voice, I think, is very distinctive too, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of, I don't know how I sound because you sound differently to yourself, right?
Yes.
When you hear yourself, you're like, wait, what?
I have that too, though. My voice gets me caught in public.
Yeah.
You know, if I have a hat on or sunglasses or someone hasn't noticed in a crowd, but I start speaking to somebody, heads start turning.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah. So that's really funny. I have that too. You mentioned the Today Show. So, okay. We have a disaster at CNN and then you go to Atlanta and you're producing and you're learning and you're getting into your body, which I also think is a big thing for women. I think so many women, the tension of wanting to be good and right and impress people, like when it closes your chest up right here, can really bring your voice up into that nervous space. So you're settling into yourself. How do we get from there to the Today Show? How does that happen?
Is that insane?
It's so crazy.
Well, I have a long story about CNN, which I'm writing about right now for my book.
Can we get a preview or are we saving it?
Let's just say that I had an encounter with an executive that I think later came back to haunt me a bit. And I'll get into more details because I actually saved a memo that I kept from 1984. Isn't that crazy?
Whoa.
But anyway, so
I
ended up leaving CNN and moving to Miami to be a local news reporter. Mm. And that was really so important because that gave me the day in, day out experience of reporting, of going to the Chrome Detention Center where a lot of Haitian refugees were staying or kept and doing stories on, I mean, that was sort of multiculturalism 101 to live in Miami in the 80s, and the Mariel boat lift. I loved sort of the color and the flavor of Miami. I loved that it was such a melting pot. It was so fun. I lived in Coconut Grove. But anyway, I did a lot of reporting, maybe 2 stories a day sometimes. Crime was really bad then, so there were crime, immigration issues, and many reporters from Miami go on to be network reporters because so many stories there are national stories, not just local stories. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then I got offered a job in Washington in local news and did that for a couple of years, which was fun. I loved WRC and I loved the people there. And that's when Tim Russert saw me and said, this girl's got game. She's got it going on. And he offered me a job as the deputy Pentagon correspondent. I had to learn all about the military. On my honeymoon, I was studying F-14s and M1A1 tanks and all sorts of military hardware, much to my husband's chagrin. And then I did that for about a year and a half, and they started asking me to read the news on the Today Show. And I had never anchored. I was a reporter. I was like a scrappy street reporter. And I started learning how to read the teleprompter. I wasn't very good at it, and read the news. And then from there, one thing led to another. they had a debacle on the Today Show with Jane Pauley and Deborah Norville, and they were looking for a solution, and they thought that I would be a good solution to their problem. So it was a little right place at the right time, a little, you know, I was had all this experience under my belt, having been told they never wanted to see me on the air. It was really actually a very positive thing. And in hindsight, I do appreciate what Reese Schoenfeld said back in the day. So that's how it all came to pass.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I can't believe, you know, it's so, life goes by so quickly. You know, I was there for 15 years at CBS for 5 years, did a syndicated talk show, went to Yahoo for 5 years, and now I'm starting my own company, which is exciting. But God, time goes by so quickly. What do they say? The days are long, but the years are short. And it's so true.
I feel that too.
So like every day, kind of, I don't know, write a journal and make sure you make the most of it. I wish I had written a journal because I'm writing my book right now. And I'm thinking, God, I wish I had written how I felt that day.
Yes.
And what exactly happened. And it's so helpful.
I'm working on starting that process actually because I look back at my life and think, God, I should have been keeping records.
I know. And luckily, I have a lot of scripts and articles. My parents kept scrapbooks of all my articles.
That's so cute.
I have 6 scrapbooks that my mom and dad, you know, painstakingly and meticulously put together. And they were so sweet to do that. But I also kept everything. So I have boxes and boxes of stuff
that
I'm finding. I mean, I'm just super sentimental, and I just keep things. And I thought, well, Monday I may want to write a book about my experiences. It'll be cathartic and interesting for me. Maybe it could be helpful to other people. Maybe it'll be borderline interesting. So I'm glad I kept all that stuff.
I love that. So I have a question. When we talk about the Today Show, you know, all of these incredible, powerful moments that you get to experience, you know, as an anchor, as a newswoman with the country. But I think people often forget when you are a leader in a space that your life is being experienced with the country as well. It's kind of a two-way mirror, you know? I think about it like that glass in the police station, like that you see on Law and Order. Mariska's always in the back, like watching the guy through the thing. It's that, there is that for any person in the public eye. And I'm curious about what some of your, you know, your biggest and best memories are with the country as you're heading the Today Show. And I'm also curious if you'd be willing to share what it was like to go through some of your toughest and most personal experiences as, you know, the face of the nation, because you mentioned Jay, you know, your husband passed and your sister passed away while you were anchoring. And I just can't fathom what it must have been like to have to show up for people during those experiences. And I think that the duality of that is so beautiful and heartbreaking and special. And I wonder what that looks like now.
Yeah. Well, I'm also writing a lot about that. And you know, I think there's something very unique about a morning show, or was, I think, especially when the landscape was less fragmented, you know, that was a cultural and a daily touchstone for people. And I think as a result, people who have someone in their living room or bedroom every morning, they feel very close to that person. You know, people used to say, I feel like I know you. And I used to respond, well, you kind of do, because they saw me in all kinds of situations. Of course, there's a lot of me they don't know, but they saw me being funny or serious or sad or whatever. So it's this multidimensionality that people get to be a part of that doesn't always happen, say, on an evening newscast. And I was am a very open and accessible person. You know, I sort of don't put on airs at all. I'm the same person, at least on the Today Show, on camera as I am off. And so it's a very intimate thing. And I appreciated it, actually. I'd never felt it was intrusive or weird. I liked that people felt close to me. And it was very difficult during Jay's illness. He was sick for 9 months. Mm. And I think in a weird way, the Today Show was a safe space for me. Those 2 hours, which there were only 2 hours back then, was the only time I wasn't thinking and terrified and obsessively researching how I could help my husband. Mm. So it took me away from that. I described it as feeling like my heart was in a vice 24/7. Mm. And suddenly I could get away from that and focus on the news of the day or do an interview. And it was the only time I could kind of forget. Of course, during the commercials, that's all I thought about. But I didn't have enough brain space to focus on, you know, a big story or interviewing a CEO or talking, debriefing a reporter or, you know, covering politics or foreign policy and be thinking about my husband's metastatic colon cancer. Mm. So it was intrusive when, like, the National Enquirer would report on us and say all these things. I felt like it, because Jay wasn't a public figure, I was. And I just didn't think they had a right to talk about Jay's private situation. Mm-hmm. It was just nobody's business but
it's
ours.
So invasive.
Yeah. And, but I feel like, you know, when Jay died, I had probably 10,000 cards. I had mass cards from total strangers. I had sympathy cards. I had notes. I had people. It was actually incredibly moving and incredibly generous and lovely that all these people would write to me, you know? I mean, yeah. I saw such an incredible side of humanity that was so, it was just so comforting. Mm. And so I really appreciated that closeness that viewers felt to me and the fact that they reached out to me in this time of terrible sorrow and were willing to actually put pen to paper and spend the time to craft something beautiful to me and to share their own pain. I mean, I thought it was honestly very profound. And I've gone through some of those recently, you know, mass cards from just, you know, Jay was Catholic and, you know, these people who, you know, got these leather-bound, beautiful, I'm not Catholic, so I hadn't really seen them in these leather cases with gold, you know, engraved writing and Jay's name filled in. Wow. And it was just incredible. So I felt, you know, the collective embrace of so many people, and it was really powerful. Mm. So, you know, that's how I got through doing the Today Show during those 9 months. And then when my sister was sick, and I think I'm very good at compartmentalizing, honestly, and that served me well during those difficult times. And, you know, I actually was just at a dinner for 41 mayors at, Mike Bloomberg has a thing where he helps mayors. He's just, you know, he's given more to cities than any person in history. That's
incredible.
he's just such a phenomenally generous and philanthropic person. And it's really, I think, changing the world in the best way. I think, you know, he's putting money towards so many social issues that I care deeply about, whether it's reducing gun violence or health and, I mean, and the environment. He's awesome, really. Yeah, I wish he had run for president. I think he would not have liked campaigning because he's not a real people person. You know, he's not super gregarious and probably all the glad handing would have gotten on his nerves. But he's an extraordinary manager, I think. And I just think he would have been a phenomenal president. Mm. I really do. I think that probably for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, I think he, you know, he does have certain opinions that he's not going to change and he's not going to lean toward the left in any way, shape, or form. But I think he's just amazing. Anyway, I was bringing that up because someone came up to me and she was the mayor of, trying to remember where she was the mayor. She was really nice. And she said, I just want you to know that growing up, to see you covering 9/11, and it was such an important experience for me. So I think 9/11 is probably the one event that really stands out and makes me, you know, I'm very proud of it. And I also feel like...
Your coverage of that, you mean?
Yeah. Mm. You know, being kind of a steady hand during this chaotic, terrifying time was a really important experience for me. So I think about that. And there are, of course, many more that I'm thinking about and writing about. But that certainly stands out. Mm-hmm. And again, I think, circling back to Jay's death, doing a colonoscopy on air.
That was incredible.
And, you know, I just thought, gosh, I've learned so much. It would be almost criminal not to share this.
Yes.
And the fact that this is a life-saving screening procedure.
Yes.
And
that's so, and that the numbers shot so drastically up after you
did
that.
Yeah, not enough, not enough. There's still not enough compliance. And one thing that's really scary, Sophia, which your listeners should be aware of, is that colon cancer cases among young people are increasing dramatically, and they don't know why. They don't know whether it's associated with obesity. There are other theories. Maybe it's the overprescription, of antibiotics. I'm fascinated with this whole conversation about the microbiome.
Yes.
Which I really want to learn more about.
And the microbiome. Woman for you to interview.
Really? It actually can affect your mental health, which is so interesting to me.
Yeah, the gut is actually the building block of your mental stability.
Yeah, I think that's so crazy. Like, I want someone to help me understand that.
Oh, I have a great person.
Okay, good.
You said that younger and younger people are getting colorectal cancer, and I'm 37. Do I need to go have a colonoscopy this year? Should I have one at 40? When do we really need to start thinking about that? Because until you said that, I hadn't considered that that was something that needed to be on my radar.
I mean, I think it's something you should talk to your doctor about because the blanket recommendation is 50 for your first screening colonoscopy, although the American Cancer Society has lowered that age for your first screening to 45.
Wow.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be a colonoscopy. Many people consider it the gold standard. But if you have any, you know, a lot of it has to do with family history, although family history is no guarantee. Jay's mom had ovarian cancer, his grandmother had breast cancer, so these adenocarcinomas can be slightly hereditary, they believe. But, you know, so Ellie and Carrie will need to be screened at 30 because Jay was diagnosed at 41, and you get diagnosed 10 years before your first-line relative was diagnosed.
Wow.
And I think a lot of doctors I talk to do get screened at 40, which I think is quite telling, but I think it's something that you just need to discuss with your doctor and be keenly aware of the symptoms of like bloating or irregular bowels, or when they say blood in your stools, it doesn't necessarily mean you have red in the toilet bowl. It may be your stools are discolored, darker than usual. So I think it's important just to be educated about it and then talk to your doctor and make sure you have a doctor who listens to you. You know, a lot of people say they go to their doctor and they complain about symptoms and the doctor blows that person off and says, oh, you probably have hemorrhoids, and they don't really take it seriously. And so I think, you know, I'm not encouraging people to be hypochondriacs, but I do think that if you feel like something's wrong with you, go to a doctor who takes you seriously. And if that doctor doesn't, find another doctor.
And perhaps this is ignorant, but I just don't know. What kind of a doctor do you even go to?
Your internist can talk to you, and then he'll or she or he will recommend a gastroenterologist.
Okay, so you see an internist first and then a gastro.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, Jay didn't see a doctor regularly. Like many young men, he played lacrosse and football in college. He was healthy. He didn't drink to excess. He never smoked a cigarette. And, you know, I think that he just thought he was healthy. And men really need to go get physicals every year.
Yes.
They just have to. Women, because they're part, they go to OBGYNs generally, hopefully, are much more in the system and have a medical professional with whom they can discuss things. Mm-hmm. But a lot of men, I think, don't. And I really would urge any guy out there, any woman who has a guy in her life or a brother or whatever, to encourage them to see a doctor regularly. I don't know if Jay's cancer would have been detected, but maybe a doctor would have said, you know, how are you feeling, or examined his belly, or talked to him about different things that might have pointed to the fact that he had this cancer growing inside him.
Mm. Thank you for sharing all that. I think that'll be really helpful for people.
So get screened, people.
Yeah. Yeah. You took your platform and you helped to create Stand Up to Cancer. And it literally makes me teary-eyed. You guys have raised over $600 million for cancer research.
I mean, just nine crazy women.
It's so amazing.
Which I should probably stop saying, but I do think it's worth saying that nine women got together and said, enough. The pace is too slow. Mm. Like, let's put our foot on the gas and let's support cancer research. And it is pretty effing phenomenal, isn't it?
It's phenomenal. And when you say, you know, nine crazy women, I get what you're saying, because what you're really saying is we're just these nine people.
Right.
And isn't it crazy that this happened? And it makes me think of that Steve Jobs quote, you know, the crazy ones, where he says, like, it's only the ones crazy enough to think they can change the world who do.
Well, it's also like that Margaret Mead quote, which I love, which is never doubt the power of a small group of individuals to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
Yes.
Or something like that. Sorry, Margaret Mead fans out there. If I probably misquoted that slightly.
I think you did very well. What has been the best experience for you working with Stand Up to Cancer, the dream teams and the telethons and the sort of global support? You know, how is it going?
I mean, so much has been a great experience. I'm not in the trenches day in and day out. And a lot of my friends and colleagues who are founders are, and I owe them a huge debt of gratitude for keeping the flame going. And I am involved, obviously, and do what I can, but they are kind of day in and day out in there. Mm. And gosh, there have been so many spectacular moments. So many. I mean, from celebrating scientists who get very little attention or public accolades, and, you know, to show that we are a nation grateful for their hard work and that we want to support what they do, and to even get to know them. They're brilliant and humble and so focused on helping other people. Mm-hmm. So to be able to be in their company is such a privilege, truly. Mm-hmm. Then there, of course, are the patients. I can't tell you how many people come to me or write to me or DM me and want to know how I can help them with their cancer situations. Mm. And sometimes I can and often I can't. Mm-hmm. But to see hope for the people who are in the throes of it, and to see actually people getting better. Mm. And to see scientists working together for the good of their patients, and to meet people who have dealt with cancer and are on the other side. And, you know, there's a young woman named Pierce who I met when I was doing a story for CBS, and she was at CHOP, which is the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. And she was very, very sick, and she had a onesie on. You know, she was like a little preteen, and I think she was 11 maybe. And now she's graduating. She graduated from college. Mm. And she's a phenomenal success story. And I meet women like that and men like that all the time. Emily Whitehead, who survived childhood cancer thanks to science. So I mean, there's just so many things that I feel grateful and that I've learned about and been exposed to because of Stand Up to Cancer. Mm. And just makes you feel like you are giving something back to the world. And you know, we have six drugs have been approved by the FDA. I think there's one just in the last couple of weeks. So we're making progress. It's too slow for my taste still, but we're helping people. And so to contribute to the efforts of many organizations and many scientists and institutions, but to play a role in that is very gratifying. You know, I wish I weren't in this position in some ways. I wish that my husband was here and my sister would have been the first female governor of Virginia. Mm. We're all convinced of that. But absent of that, the fact that I can contribute in some small way or some pretty nice way, you know, is great.
And when you think about this kind of activism, both in the philanthropic space and in the political space, I'm curious how you think concerned citizens and activists can emulate what you guys are doing, push for greater social change, because you've got the experience from inside of Stand Up to Cancer. You've got all the know-how of the American political landscape, and you traveled the country for America Inside Out for a year after Trump was elected, and all of the topics that you were covering were so ahead of the curve, which was so wild. You had this debate over taking down statues and political correctness and women in Hollywood and Silicon Valley. And,
I know, isn't that crazy? I was doing gender inequality in Hollywood, and I remember calling, writing to Meryl Streep and asking her about it. And it
casual.
I know. I don't mean that, but I'd interviewed
amazing.
Her before, and I thought I'd like to get her take on it.
Yeah.
And this whole sort of Me Too thing didn't even enter the conversation. It was more about like men don't want to see films done by women or chick flicks. And it was just, I think this whole, you know, deep-rooted sexism that was so pervasive, it just had not come to the surface yet. So isn't it crazy that this happened while I was exploring? I started with a simple question. Why are there so few female directors? I was like, I always read about it. I was like, what is holding women back so much in Hollywood? Mm. Almost more than other places. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I got to figure this out. I got to understand it.
Wow. So what do you think? Gleaning all these lessons, how do you think those of us out there who want to push culture forward, where do we begin?
Oh God! Well.
Are there sort of temple ideas?
Well, Sophia, let me tell you. I feel like, you know, the wise woman imparting her knowledge. I think there are a myriad of ways. Mm-hmm. I think you do. You know, you can do something in your own community. Mm-hmm. I do think it should be actionable. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's one thing to raise a ruckus about something and to protest. But I do think people want to feel there's something they can actually do that will lead to change.
Yes.
It's not just the bitching and the moaning, right?
Protest with policy.
Yes. Mm. Or actionable action items. Isn't that what they call it? Actionable items. And, you know, what is your goal? How can you move toward that goal with reducing gun violence? A lot of people working slowly and with great effort, state by state. Moms Demand Action. They're going to legislatures. They're following it up with, you know, they're following policy.
Yes.
And it's a lot of hard work to be part of, I think, social change and to channel your energies into things that will actually move the needle, right? So I think you have to have a goal, but you have to have the steps that you need, perhaps incremental, toward reaching that goal.
Sure.
And I think you can do it in small ways. You can donate to organizations you believe in their work. Mm. That's a, you know, what do they call that? Or you can talk about it on social media, slacktivism. You heard that expression?
Yeah.
But slacktivism is okay as long as you're doing something, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're contributing money or trying to get people engaged.
Yes.
But then I think pick a cause that you really care about and roll up your sleeves and really get in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to get skin in the game.
Yeah, and so I think, I don't know, I'm not a professional activist. I'm sure there are people who have much more wisdom in this department than I do, but You know, what I do feel very heartened about is that young people do really, really care about the world around them. And that, you know, I read articles about how baby boomers screwed everything up. And I think they're right in some ways. But the good news is, and hopefully it's not too late for things like the environment, but we're starting to see a real sea change, literally and figuratively, in terms of people saying, we've got to acknowledge these problems, we have to address them, we have to fix them.
Yeah. And when we think about sea change, you know, there have been some, there's been amazing headway made. But then even as we talk about this idea of, you know, what's keeping women out of entertainment, for example, now we've got Nora O'Donnell solo anchoring the nightly news, but she's only the third woman to ever do that.
Right.
So as we're seeing all this great change, why do you think in certain arenas like the news, it feels like it's moving so slowly?
Well, I think partially it's because the leadership of most of these organizations are men. And I think they're the victims of cultural conditioning that makes them judge women a certain way by certain standards. And, oh gosh, this is a long conversation about glass ceilings and but also about glass cliffs. And
what do you mean by that?
A glass cliff is sort of the expression used when a woman gets in a position of power or authority and in fact breaks the glass ceiling, that there's a glass cliff because she's held to different standards and she falls off of it, and then that hurts other women who are coming up. So
she falls off or gets pushed.
Yeah. Or maybe she was there for the wrong reason. Who knows? Who knows? But I think that it is changing. Susan Zirinsky is the president of CBS News now. And I think, you know, versus when I was there, Sean McManus was a very nice guy who was the president of news, but he hated news. But to have someone like Z there supporting Nora, I think makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Because basically the message within the organization is heard loud and clear. This is our person. You better get in line, be supportive, or get off the train.
That's amazing.
And I think that if you don't have that message permeating into an organization or penetrating into an organization, and it's a change, then it can result in a lot of conflict and chaos. And that's sort of, I think, internally. And then you have the external things that you have to deal with too. But I think we've evolved some. And I think as more women get put in leadership position, so that's not to say all women are great leaders, just because you can't say all men are great leaders.
Of course.
But it does bring a different sensibility. And when it comes to issues of gender, I think it sends a very strong message throughout the organization.
I think one of the best ways I've ever heard it phrased, I listened to Oprah interview this 92-year-old nun, Sister Joan Chittering, I believe is her last name. And she said, listen, gender equality is the thing I think we need most in the world. She said, and past it being a male-female issue, what we're saying, if we're each 50% of the population.
Well, we're 51.8.
Actually, exactly. But, the, you know,
but who's counting?
Her idea is that if people with 50% of the information are making 100% of the decisions are going to be bad.
Of course. When you look at the Women's Media Center, it's true. And that's why diversity of all kinds is really important, because everyone, you know, my mother-in-law says there's no such thing as objectivity, which is really true, because everyone brings their own experiences and frame of reference to anything they're covering or talking about. Of course, you can strive for objectivity, but if it's not just the basic where, when, you know, what, when, where, who, when, what, where, why, you know, the W's, you are infusing it with a certain kind of nuance and a certain context and a certain perspective.
Sure.
So it's so important that you have people who represent all kinds of life experience. Socioeconomic diversity is really important. Racial diversity, gender diversity, sexual orientation diversity, gender identity diversity. All those things just, I think, inform and bring a more representative form of media. And that's why it's critically important.
So when you think about representative media and diverse media, you launched your production company in 2015. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious what stories are important to you to tell, what stories you feel like have been missing from the media, and what you want to shine a light on through what you're now at the helm of.
Well, I think politics, I've always loved politics, but I think the political environment we're in now is sucking so much of the oxygen out of the room that we haven't really addressed some big social issues. And I'm sort of interested in talking about things along the lines I did in America Inside Out. What is it like to be a Muslim in America right now? And why is there so much prejudice against, in some cases, in some quarters, Muslim Americans? And so I'm teaming up with companies. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Companies are now, some authentically, some less authentically, associating with a purpose. Because, first of all, according to the Edelman Trust Barometer, something like 78% of employees are looking to their CEOs and company leadership to take a stand on big, important social issues.
Yep.
And that's why you see Nike and Levi's and all kinds of companies, and P&G has been at the forefront, stepping into these, and sometimes stepping into it, but really thinking and being forward-facing about addressing some of these problems. And so because the advertising model is kind of broken, at least in the digital landscape, I'm teaming up with these companies to talk about things like criminal justice reform or gender equality, the importance of female mentorship, the environment, what's going on with plastic, and how can we really, you know, why is recycling such a failure? So all these things that I think I'm interested in understanding more, and I think people are craving. And it's not only important to maintain a millennial workforce that doesn't want to work for a company that cares only about the bottom line, but also consumers want companies to stand for something.
Yes.
And so it's sort of a halo effect of saying we care about our community and we care about our country.
It's
so that's
true.
What I'm doing. And it's been really interesting, and a lot of people are interested in working with me, which is very gratifying too.
I love that. Many years, probably 7 years ago now, there's a big conference that you should know called MCON in the Midwest. And it's all the big CMOs of all the big brands. And I was asked to keynote, and they were like, you're this social media activist. How do we get to millennials? And I got up on stage and said, you guys want me to talk to you about how to appeal to millennials? Stop lying to us. That was my opening of my talk, and the whole room kind of, and then I was like, I'm not here just to make you feel bad, but let's break it down. And we went through this whole thing, and it was the most fun that I'd had, because I got to say, this is a campaign that we knew was a lie. This is a campaign that really took a risk and had something to say. And it was so fun to unpack for these people how you can really take responsibility as a brand, because you're a financial force in the world, and how that's really required, and to see what's been happening in this last 5 years especially. It's very exciting to me. I'm glad you're doing this. I think it's so great. The thing I'm also so excited about with your company is your newsletter, which I'm obsessed with.
Thank you.
Also, thanks for putting me in it. That was so sweet. I like saw myself on your Instagram. I sent it to my mom. I was like, Mom, I'm having a moment. I'm on Katie Couric's like recommended list. What's happening? It was so cool.
Well, that's fun. And you know, I don't know about you, but I mean, it's hard. I'm listening to you. I'm like, how does Sophia know that about that conference? I don't know how you find the time in the day to consume and learn. It's hard.
I wonder that about you too, though. I wonder how everyone can be so abreast of all the topics and reading all the books.
I mean, I am trying, and I'm trying to help other people, because you can go down a rabbit hole of completely useless information on your phone. So I'm trying to say, hey, before you leave, you know, your house, or while you're on the subway, or here's some of the things that are happening in the world by someone you trust, hopefully, and by someone you know a little, possibly, and someone who you feel is a good person. And so I feel like there are a lot of newsletters from entities but not many from actual living human beings.
Wow.
And so I usually start by telling people, like this morning I talked about interviewing John F. Kennedy Jr. in his last TV interview before he died, and this is the 20th anniversary of his death, and it still makes me so sad and all that lost potential. And so I try to make it a little personal, but also pretty readable and accessible. So I'm glad you like it. Tell your listeners to subscribe. They can go to katiekirk.com, or you know, you can text 474747. This is something I just learned. And you just write my name, Katie, and then you sign up for it. Isn't that crazy?
That's so cool.
Technology is incredible.
Technology is amazing.
Yeah.
I signed up the good old-fashioned way online.
But good.
That's cool. I like a text.
Yeah, and you can go to my Instagram, too, and there's
your
a sign up there.
Your Instagram is great.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, I like it. I'm into
Instagram
it.
Instagram is so interesting, isn't it?
I check you really frequently, and I check Jessica Yellen really frequently
as
well.
Yeah, Jessica's doing a great job of
that
breaking
things down. That
whole
news, not noise thing she's doing is so helpful.
Right.
So, yeah, you guys are sort of my
gurus. Trying to kind of, I do kind of a mix of personal and professional.
Which I love.
Yeah.
People like that too.
Yeah. Trying to kind of, you know, remind people of the sort of relationship I had with them on the Today Show.
Yeah. Well, and it's a new iteration of that, which
right.
feels so familiar to us. And I think, again, you help us all feel safe. So
well,
thank
thanks.
You.
Thank you. I try.
So this is something I ask everyone. The title of the podcast is called Work in Progress. And I think for so many people who are outside looking in at a person like you, they think she's got it all figured out. And I'm
talk
always,
to my husband.
I'm always so curious. What feels like a work in progress in your life right now, whether it's professional, personal, political, maybe you're trying to organize the junk drawer. I don't know. I'm just curious what you're
That's
working
funny.
On.
We call it the junk drawer. My mom used to call it the goodie drawer because we put all like re-gifting things in the goodie drawer.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I think I am a work in progress when it comes to getting older. You know, I'm 62. As I said, time has gone by so quickly. My daughter's getting married. My other daughter is out of college and just got her master's at Columbia. Go Carrie. And Ellie's working, writing for an Amazon show called The Boys that comes out soon. And, you know, I think life stages are challenging. I think this stage is challenging. I think how do you stay engaged? And I hate the word relevant, but how do you continue to do work that you like and love? And how do you, you know, how do you find the right balance of personal and professional? How do you, you know, pick what you're going to really get involved in? And discernment, according to the Maharishi, someone told me not too long ago that discernment is the most important word in the English language or in any language, I guess. And figuring out sort of what you're going to do with your time, where you're going to put it, especially when so much of your life is, or a lot of your life is in the rearview mirror, and you have a limited runway before you. So I think I'm a work in progress in trying to really figure out how I can be a force for good in whatever way I can, and also how I can be there for my friends and family, and how I can have fun. I'm a big proponent of loving, you know, life and enjoying myself, you know, with so many options. I'm lucky. You know, I'm so lucky. I'm in a position where I have a lot of options, thank goodness, because not everyone does. But that's what I'm sort of trying to figure out right now. That's where my work is hopefully progressing.
I love that. Thank you. This show is executive produced by me, Sophia Bush, and Sim Sarna. Our supervising producer is Allison Bresnick. Our associate producer is Caitlin Lee. Our editor is Josh Windisch. And our music was written by Jack Garrett and produced by Mark Foster. This show is brought to you by Brilliant Anatomy.